Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for doing my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Dan Bramski. Bramski Studio Architecture. That's I don't know why we're laughing, but yeah.
We'll just get it out of the way now.
Yeah.
So we can cry later.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love that. You're an architect.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's pretty
cool.
It's
fun.
It's pretty cool. It's like something when you're a kid, you know, you think about, what if I was an architect? Or you look at a building and you go, I could design a building.
Yeah. And I think we're all architects for a little while if our parents give us Legos or Kinects. What did you have? Did you have anything that was building oriented?
We had stress, but no, we also had Legos. We had guilt trips and stress. No, we had Legos. My brother and I had those giant plastic bins of Legos.
Yes.
And we would dump them on the floor. I think I had one and he had one. We would literally have just a floor of Legos and we would build. I mean, we didn't get those fancy, like, it's a Batman thing or Star Wars thing. It was just like, you get the Legos that are on sale or you get the Legos that are given to you and the colors you got, the sizes you have, whatever, build what you want.
And they're all commingled into a large toolbox or some sort of Rubbermaid bin, and it doesn't matter. And mine is still that way. My parents are still holding on to them. But with my boys, it's you have to build the dragon or the Ninjago thing. And then you have to look at it. You can't touch it. It's just there forever. It goes on the shelf and you look at it and it's pretty.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me want to take it apart and then see how quickly that comes back together. Or maybe there's like kind of like nailed it, you know, where it's like you try to make the Star Wars thing or you try to make the pirate ship, but kind of looks like it.
See, I was expecting you to say I would take it apart and build something different, because that's kind of what you do in life is you look at these existing systems and say, oh, I'm going to do something incredibly different now. What can I do with this?
Well,
did
here,
I go too
here
deep
you
there?
Are on my podcast giving me a compliment. And I'll take it.
Okay.
I'm tired. I work hard. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And that is what I try to do, is I try to learn the systems and the structures, how boring that they are, and demystify them, communicate them, change them, mix it up, shake it up. You know, I'm that person at the table who they're like, oh, hey, you look like every other white person. And then I'm like, no, bitch, we're going to have black women here, and this is not the budget, and we're not doing it because Deb wants it that way. We're going to try it differently. And Deb is just someone I made up. You know, the person who's like, oh, don't do it that way because Deb has to sign off on it. Deb won't say yes to your new idea. She hasn't said yes for 20 years.
Yeah. No, I sense some of that too, because in my work, a lot of the times the biggest challenge is going in for a building permit or a land use permit and going through this process. And of course, there's lots of rules in place because somebody's put them there for a reason. But at some point, every once in a while, we get so far from what the intent of the rule is that we have to ask, hey, let's step back. Let's take a common sense of look at this and say, is this really what we're supposed to be doing? Because what we want to do seems reasonable, but for some reason, the code isn't allowing it.
And it may not even be because of safety or health. We get that. It may just be like, that's what they've been doing for 40 years.
Yes. And not to get too far into it to distract us, but a lot of planning and zoning codes in American cities are all about NIMBYism. They're all about providing for wealthy landowner white families.
Yeah.
And keeping everybody else out.
The people who can afford their own septic tank.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. You know, I don't know if confess is the word. I have to tell folks that you are our architect. You are helping Andy and I with our kitchen plans. And then you also did a really great job working on Andy's parents' home in Neskowin, taking a very small beach cottage and modernizing it. So thank you for being our family architect.
I know. I kind of feel like Oh gosh, who was that in The Godfather? The associate. He's not in the mafia, but he's there to always assist with the family.
That'd be interesting. I'm thinking.
I don't know if I should make that comparison. I'm probably going to get in trouble now by somebody.
It makes me think. Have you ever seen that? There's an SNL sketch where people pitch shows to Netflix and Netflix executives just like throw money at them.
Yes.
They're like, yes, Babysitter wins a car. Yes, here's money. So it's like yours is like Architect, who's also in the mob. Great.
Yeah.
Let's fund that. New content.
Okay. We're going somewhere. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. That's more believable than people not catching Dexter.
Yeah.
After so many years. So, okay. So you grew up in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Playing Legos.
Playing Legos.
In what I presume to be a somewhat conservative Midwestern town? Or
yes.
No? Okay.
So I grew up in Oakdale. As we mentioned, this is the town where Derek Chauvin lived until about 2 years ago. But yeah, very run-of-the-mill, mostly white suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm the youngest of three kids. My parents are still in the same house that we moved into when I was two. Kind of a very, Leave It to Beaver.
I was just
sort of childhood.
And you said Leave It to Beaver. Okay.
And it's funny because the only reason I bring that up now is because I realize like how unique that is. Mm-hmm. For example, my children, whom we might talk about later. Mm-hmm. I adopted them from the foster care system and they've had this wild, crazy life mm-hmm. and living in the same house and having the same two parents that always have jobs and nothing ever changes is actually mm-hmm. pretty unusual in the world. And so so I kind of had that upbringing.
Were your parents like neighborly, you know, like my parents are nice. Well, my dad passed away, but nice, but not very, you know, like Dave and Kathy are like salt of the earth, like bake a pie, come on over. Oh, we're having a party or a barbecue. Come on over. Were your parents like that or were they somewhat quiet?
They were quieter. I don't remember having people over for dinner. We never had big parties. This is in contrast to my husband, who's the youngest of eight, who grew up in Hawaii in a military family. And they had a pool in the backyard and they had these huge parties all the time with other military families. And so it's funny because, and they even had a little cottage that they would rent out in their backyard. So he came from this huge kind of chaotic party family.
I wouldn't even be able to keep
family.
Track of eight kids.
Yeah.
Imagine eight kids on Target.
No. And so I came, you know, our family by comparison was much, my parents were friendly and kind to people, but we were a little bit more, I would say, isolated.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a lunch lady for, I think, 27 years in our school district. So she was oftentimes there when I was at school. And then my dad is a firefighter for 30 years for the city of St. Paul. And that's kind of a lifestyle in its own right.
So they are, I mean, salt of earth, bread and butter Americans doing...
And I'm an Eagle Scout. I'll throw that out there.
You know what? I actually added that to my notes to ask you about it. You should throw that out there because you're a fucking Eagle Scout.
That's right.
So I'm trying to think if we're on a hike, if you still remember, you're tying knots, you're giving me a tourniquet, you're starting a fire.
I can start a fire. As for knots, I'm probably not going to be able to help you there.
Come on.
Square knots? Sure. I've got that. First aid, maybe. We'll just see what happens. It might just come back. You know how sometimes in emergencies you remember things you've forgotten for 20 years that.
Or you just.
God willing.
Or you pause or walk away.
Yeah. Or I can just start running away. Yeah.
So, okay. Mr. Eagle Scout, tell me about that. Cause that seems to be another layer of your life. I mean, I was a Cub Scout. I think I tried Boy Scouts for a moment and then I was like, no, not really my thing. So you finished Cub Scouts and then you finished Boy Scouts.
Yes.
So that was a pretty big part of your life. I mean, tell me about that. And then.
So this is part of a bigger story. our mutual friend, Jen, told me what it is. She said, oh, you're a completionist. And I said, what is that? She said, oh, you're somebody who, when you're challenged with a task, you want to complete it. You want to get all the merit badges. You want to get all of the book it pizza points. And so I was, you know, I was an Eagle Scout.
Does society frown upon, like, you flunked out of Boy Scouts?
No, not all the time. But I think I was that kid who wanted to go out and succeed. And I think that my parents set me up into a lot of activities, and then some of them stuck and some of them didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think scouting was one of those. You know, I kind of liked the achievement-oriented nature of it. I now look back on it as a gay man living in Portland, Oregon, thinking, how did I last that long in it?
As you wear that outfit for your husband.
I haven't yet. Note to self.
So what, I mean, did you know that his, I mean, it's Boy Scouts has changed and Girl Scout has as well. You know, it's,
it is,
it wasn't necessarily, even though we knew, I mean, you know, Wendy is clearly a lesbian, you know, like we clearly kind of like, were you out? Do you remember if you look back on it, did you have like a crush on like somebody in the organization or someone who was a Boy Scout? You were like, I'm going to camp in your tent. Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There were always crushes. And I feel it was probably the more like salt of the earth, all American boys that were in Scouts. So that helped. But, yeah, I would say I didn't come out. I started coming out to my parents, my family, and my friends when I was 16, but I didn't come out until I was 18 when I went to college.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would say more than my identity as a scout was I was a competitive swimmer from fourth grade on. So I was on the varsity team for high school starting in seventh grade.
I did not.
And I'm also an All-American, Michael. I don't want to brag about that.
I did not prepare for all of the accolades. I did not know. I mean,
I also got the Gay Lutheran Scholarship.
The Gay of Thrones Scholarship?
The Gay Lutheran Scholarship.
Oh, I don't know.
I went to college.
Gay of Thrones.
Still haven't watched it. Don't shame me.
I said Gay of Thrones, not Game of Thrones. Okay, so that is a complex identity. I mean,
yeah.
A swimmer, an Eagle Scout. Religious person, I imagine.
Yeah, we were involved in the church.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah. I think it really stems from my mom. She grew up two houses from her church, and that was the center of her family's life. So it wasn't just like going to church. It was all social functions. I think she went to her church's school until eighth grade. And so that kind of translated into our family of, oh, if you're going to do, you know, if you're going to move to the suburbs, you've got to do all the good things. Your kids have to take piano lessons. You're going to be active in the church, part of that community. Your kids are going to be Boy Scouts. And then of course I became a swimmer after, in my mind, failing at a bunch of other sports that I hated. We went through all of them. And then by fourth grade, swimming was where it was at. And I was doing well. So
it's where the cute boys are at.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, it was just, I feel like seriously, the more and more I talk about it, it really feels like the Leave It to Beaver sort of life.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for some people, exploring that or having an identity different from that is actually really difficult and a really big challenge, because mm-hmm. there's this fear of, do I be myself and lean into that with the risk of being kicked out of the church or being right. shunned, or do I sort of, you know, maintain this I'm a good Christian boy
mm-hmm.
kind of scenario? So, yeah. I mean, were you faced with that? Did you think about like, I could just be quiet, or?
I would say my MO, at least until I was 18, was kind of do as you're told or do as it's been suggested to you and kind of do the right thing, stay on the right side of things. I think I was really good at following orders. And I think part of it's also in the Midwest, I don't think anybody's ever taught to stand out. It's they're all very nice, sweet people, but nobody drives BMWs or Mercedes. Everyone kind of fits in and conforms, and everything's a little bit more subdued. And it's not like life, I would say, out on the coasts where people are a little bit more, I don't know, flamboyant or confident. And I think, yeah, honestly, coming from this like Minnesotan Lutheran background of being humble and being quiet, kind of guided my childhood. And then when I was 18, I went to the University of Minnesota, which was really, I don't know, half an hour from my house. So it wasn't a different world, but it kind of was, because you're at least in the city, you know, you're away from your parents, away from your family, and you get to be friends with whoever you want to be friends with. So I would say I came out of my shell more at that point. But for me, the big leap was when I moved to Oregon. I had talked to a couple architecture professors from undergrad, and they said, grad school's your excuse to leave if you want to. Because I had already been considering leaving the Midwest, and most people's response was, well, why do you need to leave? Because I think I'm the third generation American born. And so everybody in our family came over in the 19 teens, settled in Minnesota, and that was good enough for them. You know, it reminded them of their homeland. And
why didn't they pick a warmer spot?
I know. Why didn't they go to Hawaii?
Keep going. It's cold.
Yeah. No, it was just like Norway. And so I think I was one of the first to leave.
Did your family, were they okay with that? Did they treat it as like, oh, he's saying fuck us, he's leaving? Or was it very much like, he's going to make us proud in his whole new life? And
I don't know. I think that my parents were sad that I was leaving, or I don't know if they thought maybe I'm just going to go to grad school for 2 years and then come back and work in the cities. I think there was also that question too about like, well, why do you need to leave? You have everything here. This is where your family is, but that's also the culture that they grew up in. You know, my mom's mom lived in two houses her entire life, and they were a mile apart. And like, that's kind of the example of like how far people would move or not move. I don't know. And also part of this, it's hard to ask because we don't have deep in-person conversations in the Midwest. You don't talk about a lot. I feel like it is a very...
Is that because it gets too deep or dirty and so there's an avoidance component?
I think so. I don't know where it comes from. But I remember a few years ago, I was seeing a therapist, and I feel like 6 months into our relationship, I mentioned that I was from Minnesota, and her eyes just lit up like, oh, that's what we're dealing with here.
That's what we're dealing with.
And I thought, I'm sorry. Should I have told you this 6 months ago so we could speed things up?
And is that because you would have like talked around things or said things, you know, euphematically? So
yes,
she had to like dig like, yeah. No, Dan, like, don't tell me that that was an okay time. Tell me that was the worst fucking time in your life.
So, for example, in grad school, I had a professor tell me my project was, quote unquote, interesting. And I knew her well enough to say, where I come from, that is not a neutral word. Mm-hmm. That means it's bad and I don't like it, but I'm not telling you that. Mm-hmm. It's my passive aggressive way.
That's what I use. That's what I use. Yeah. I say,
okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
You might have a little Minnesotan in you.
That's different. Or I say, that's one way to do it.
Yes. There, I like that. Yeah. I don't know. It makes it easy to live in the Midwest because everyone's polite. But
yeah,
but it's funny. There's very, it's, I don't know like where it comes from. part of me is like, oh, it's this Northern European thing where you're not openly expressive. And I say that from having lived in Italy for like 4 months, you know, of just people being like more open and flamboyant and just saying like what's on your mind.
I also think you're just also a nice person. And so people who are nice, they tend to think about the intention behind their words and how things will be received and reflect upon.
That's part of it.
You know?
Yeah.
And of course, if you do that too much, you end up driving yourself nuts. But part of that is being kind, I guess, what I'm trying to say.
That's true. That is, yeah, that's part of just being a nice person and understanding that there are other thoughts and other ways of life that maybe you don't understand. Mm. So, you know, you shouldn't talk about them.
So you move to Oregon for grad school and you do an architectural program.
Yes. University of Oregon. Uh-huh.
What was that? Tell us about that.
Ironically, my education at the University of Minnesota was incredibly theoretical, and we had a lot of our professors from the East Coast schools, and it was wonderful because it really taught me how to think about things more abstractly and get to the core of design. The reason I chose U of O is because it was a much more, it's always an insult when you call architects pragmatic, but it was much more of a, I want to say, a realistic program that was a little bit more hands-on and was a little bit more technical about how buildings actually get built, getting into the science.
Isn't that what they're for? I mean, I guess there's the artistic study of architecture. Or when you said that they were theoretical and abstract, I thought like someone doing an interpretive dance about an architectural project.
Or playing in a sandbox and sculpting different forms that are supposed to evoke a certain thought or theory. Yeah. That was one of the worst tasks I had to do at the University of Minnesota. But
interesting.
No, there's...
Sounds like something that Zoolander would do when he's building a school for kids to read.
Yes, absolutely. and so Oregon had that. I knew that was a deficit. Was just having more kind of practical knowledge. And then it was also, grad school was just a time to take things seriously because I was actually paying much more for that tuition and I was a little bit older. It's not like I was a 19-year-old who was just in the city and in the college to party and hang out and go through that whole social experiment, which I feel like that's the first 2 years of college, just learning to live on your own. And it also, you know, it got me out of the Midwest. So, and then of course I would say half of the students at the University of Minnesota are from Minnesota, another quarter from Wisconsin. So, and then the rest are from around the United States, and there might be a couple international students where Oregon was much more diverse. I think in our group of 25 to 30 students, we had at least 5 or 6 international students, and then everybody else was from all over the U.S. So we had, you know, we had people from Brooklyn and North Carolina and Texas, California, Washington, Alaska. We had all parts. And so with that, you get a diversity of experiences and opinions. One of my most eye-opening experiences was in studio, I sat next to Shweta, and she's from India. And one day she just asked me, "What is St. Patrick's Day?" And I thought, oh, that's right. Because you came here 6 months ago.
Yeah.
It's March. You're wondering like who St. Patrick is. And I said, well, that's funny because from what I understand, you just get really drunk and you put shamrock themed
pot
things
of gold,
on.
Leprechaun, rainbow.
But that's all I knew about
it. She loved it. She's like, I'm in.
Yeah. And it was that great example of, oh, here's this thing that I take for granted in my world that I think everybody else understands. And some people have no idea what it means.
That is an interesting concept to think about, not just for holidays, but people who look at America and see all the silly things they do.
Yes, or anything.
Be like, oh, why are you doing this?
And then you translate that to architecture And if we keep doing the same gosh darn thing all the time, we're not going to advance as a people. Our buildings aren't going to advance. Building science is not going to advance.
Well, and culturally, there's probably architectural differences as well. Like, there's more individualistic cultures. There's cultures, you know, our thing is like, people want to have a home with 4 bedrooms and 8 bathrooms, you know, and then they're like, we just have 1 bathroom as a family. We're cool.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my clients is a professional organizer. So she goes into people's homes and she sees what they have, how they live. And she said, you know, the only difference between rich people and poor people is rich people have more space in their house to fill with junk. But, you know, it's, we were 3 kids, 2 parents, and we had 1 bathroom for a majority of our childhood, and it was fine. But yeah, that's part of, you know, that's one of my big pet peeves is American houses just need to get smaller. We have to learn to work and live in less. You know, not everybody needs their own bathroom. One of the more recent trends in nicer homes has been everybody gets their own set of washing, clothes washing and drying machines. Yeah. You get a stackable. Everyone gets a stackable.
Like a child?
Maybe the 2 kids will share their own, but it's in like their wing of the house. Mm. And then mom and dad get their own. And then maybe there's one downstairs in the mother.
And then they probably end up still not doing their laundry.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking that the washing machine then acts as a hamper and you just fill it up, but you still don't run it any more often. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're in Eugene, and do you meet your husband? By the way, we're both married to an Andrew.
We are, because Andrews are generally very sweet people. I've also, this is public knowledge now, I've dated 5 or 6 Andrews before I met my Andrew.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what happened there, but it is what it is. They're, like, they're generally very nice people. There's something to them.
That's really fascinating.
But yeah, so
we should get like a name expert or like a person. I mean, whether or not I believe some of those things, they're always so fascinating. Like,
yeah,
read my palm and then tell me about what my name means.
Yes. Oh, there's something there. I'm sure there is.
So you met Andrew and Eugene, right?
I did. Okay. Yeah. So
you just saw him, and not only is he cute, you were like, hey, you're as tall as fuck like I am.
He is. He's 6'1¾". Yeah, so I graduated from U of O. I got my first job working there. And then, of course, I was on the apps. I was on the very famous gentleman's app. And we chatted a few times, and then we never met up. And then he found me again on Tinder, I think a year later. And then we finally went out on a date. And then we actually eloped and got married 57 days later.
Really?
Yeah, we went and we happened to be in Chicago for a friend's wedding. And I said, hey, do you want to marry me? Because I think like this is it.
Wow.
So why don't you marry me and we'll just figure the rest out. And then we had a big public wedding 2 years later. Yeah.
And is it that you just knew? I mean, how do you?
Yeah, I'm always a very methodical, planned out person. I'm always very risk averse. And so I want to make sure that I have, before I jump into something, I want to know that I have figured out everything that could possibly go wrong with it.
But it's interesting because coming from someone like that, when I hear 50 days, 60 days or something, I think like, you know, you met someone in Vegas at a pool and you're like, let's get married.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, this is forever. And
yeah, I mean, he's hot. He still is hot. especially if you follow his Finsta, his workout Finsta.
I don't.
Do you know what a Finsta is?
I don't know what a Finsta is.
It's your fake Insta. So everybody has their usual Insta, and then some people have a fake Insta.
And so is the Finsta a private account or is it?
No. You can follow it just like any Insta, but I think you only tell certain people about it.
So are you pretending to steal your own identity?
I don't know. I feel like it's your, I feel like there's like the public face, and then this is like the whatever wild side you want to show.
Uh-huh.
And I only learned about this because my niece and nephew have them. I found their finstas.
Maybe I need that. Maybe that would be
Inspiring. You could have one.
So you're telling me to check out photos of your husband working out.
Yeah, because he started this finsta. Okay. I don't know if it's technically a finsta. See, I'm going to go home, and my kids will be like, Dad, that's not even right.
It's my first time hearing about that. I mean, yeah. You have teenagers, so you hear things like that. I try to.
There's a lot cool, we have to learn.
You know, and then I say things, yeah. And it's like, you know, who knows if saying words like lit, if that's still in or.
No, I think that would get you. I got shushed at my house the other night because I said. Oh, man, I was trying to call something cool, but I used. I don't think I called it dope. I was something. I was like, oh, I guess that word's done now. But yeah, so no, anyways, I'm going to try to get us back on track. But
yeah.
So I met Andrew.
You swiped right.
Yeah, I think I swiped right. So.
And then you went on a date.
Yeah.
Do you remember what your first date was?
Yeah, we met on a Sunday night and so he worked in the restaurant industry at that time. So Sunday night was his like Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently the first thing I said to him was, I have to be in bed at 10. And I was, you know, I worked in an office, so I had to be at work at 8 a.m. next morning. And I thought that I was just being communicative to say, I'm not staying out all night. I know you might want to, but like, I need to go to bed. It was also not an invitation to like, come home with me. And so he took that as a challenge. Like, oh, wow. I mean, can you imagine if you showed up to a date, a blind date, and somebody is like, I'm leaving in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a little weird.
Because, well, it sounds like you're telling them right away that you're just not interested.
I know. Yeah.
Or you have something
else. We joke
else,
about it.
Or,
yeah. But we had a couple drinks at Hot
But maybe
Valley.
He was like, God, he's pragmatic. He's responsible. He's going to go to
My
bed and he's going to
God, he's an Eagle Scout.
He's going to, he can pitch a 10 or he can work in an office.
Yeah. I don't know. And then we had our date. And I think, I mean, the reason why I'm with him is because he's always made me feel safe and secure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of other things that go with that. Obviously having his finsta, but like, and he's also an amazing parent. Like his mom was known as quote unquote, the mom. In fact, that's what's on her grave. And he's always wanted to be like that, the second version of her.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so we got married.
Did your family, I mean, I would imagine not only are you, they say you don't get gay married. You're just getting married, but not only are you marrying a man or dude, you know, but you just met him.
Mm-hmm.
So was there like, what are you doing?
Oh, I moved in with him, obviously, after our private secret elopement. And people were like, wow, Dan. But my parents knew how I operate. They've known me long enough. And they're like, oh, yeah, when Dan says he's going to do something, he's going to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just kind of figured, okay, well, you're 29. Like, you're living your life out there in Oregon. Like, we're not, you know, good for you. But yeah, definitely his, because he has 3 siblings that live in Eugene. And they were all like, who is this guy? We don't know who he is. It's weird that he's moving in with you. But I want him over.
Yeah.
So.
That's wonderful. And I know that you have 2 kids.
We do.
And you did foster to adoption. Tell me a little bit about that.
So on our first date, Andrew talked to me about my plan for children, which normally on a first date, when somebody would talk to me about children, I'd be like, whoa, buddy, don't talk to me about this. Cause
it's kind of like,
you are
sketch.
Assuming.
It's kind of like one of these sketches where you both have a checklist and you're going down and you're like,
yeah,
kids, 2 kids, 2 kids.
Well, this was probably like 3 Brandy Manhattans in. So we were at like the right level to discuss such things. But so he's the youngest of 8. He has 4 siblings who've been adopted. So adoption is part of his family's story. And to me, I was like, yeah, I'd adopt children. It seems right to me. I don't have the need to see a child with my face or my, likeness in sure. any way, or to inherit anything negative that maybe I don't like about myself, or mm-hmm. like, okay, in my family, we have toenail fungus. Oh, we just shit. All do. So now, like, I have children who don't necessarily have that predicament. I can just see Andrew listening to this now saying, why did you talk about
that? No, that's
that?
Wonderful. No, yeah. we unfiltered podcasts, so.
Okay.
I mean, I
haven't sworn yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we talked about it, and then we decided I would get my architectural license. Mm. Which is a feat, and we got publicly married in Eugene. And then once we were done with that, we figured let's move somewhere else. We want a bigger city. We knew that the Bay Area and Seattle were just not affordable. We knew that we wanted to start a family somewhat quickly. So we moved to Portland. I got a job with a firm up here. He got, he transferred jobs here.
What does he do, by the way?
So now he is the HR recruiter. But I think his new term is talent partner at Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette.
Nice.
And so they are the affiliate for Southwestern Washington and most of Oregon. And so we moved up here and we rented for a year and a half. Then we bought a house out in East Portland, north of Powell.
So we have pro-choice, gays, raising kids.
What is
wrong with this world?
I know. No, we somehow turned into the liberal family. Did you ever watch Family Matters?
Of course. I still do.
I had fantasies growing up that I would be part of that family or part of the Growing Pains family. And I think that we've essentially, Andrew and I have created the Family Matters. Is that the one with Michael J. Fox? Or am I confusing
that? No, Family Matters is a beautiful black family with
in
Steve
Chicago.
Urkel and
okay, see, I get
Laura.
This screwed up. What's the other one? It's Family
Ties.
Family Ties. Yes, thank you. And Elise Keaton mm-hmm. is the architect, but also her drawing board is in the kitchen. How sexist is that? Like, they gave her, like, we're going to let you be a liberal architect. But make a sandwich and stay in that kitchen. And then he works for a nonprofit. He works for NPR, I think. I'm not sure who our kids are going to be and fill out the roles of the children, but yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a lot because when you foster, you don't really know what to expect. You mm-hmm. don't know what the kids have been through.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard enough raising a child as it is, but then mm-hmm. there are added traumas. There could be unknown conditions or health issues, on and on.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And just to clarify, so we didn't necessarily foster to adopt. Our children were legally free and were ready to be adopted.
Gotcha.
So we actually were part of, there's a committee. Once you get two or three families that submit their home study, then DHS will put together a committee and the committee will choose one family as a primary choice, one family is a backup choice, or they can choose no families because they're trying to get the family that's the best fit for the children. So we found out about our kids on December 18th, 2019. We had back and forth for 6 months with a caseworker. And then in the beginning of May of 2020, we found out, oh, they want to take us to committee. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, they had, quote unquote, advertised our children on Wednesday's Child. And so it was that we could have a whole podcast about just that
process.
They're
siblings, right?
They are bio siblings.
Yeah.
Yep. And then committee decided that we were the choice. So that was May 18th. We got to meet them 2 days later, and they moved in permanently to our house on June 9th. Hmm. So you go from being this abstract possibility to, boom, you are chosen to be their parents and you don't even get to meet the kids yet. So you have no idea how you gel. And our boys at the time were 8 and 13.
What does the kid know that they've been chosen? Do they have any sort of information in this process?
Once they start going through the process, they kind of feel it out. Their caseworker and their CASA, which is their court-appointed special mm-hmm. advocate,
CASA so great, yeah.
Oh, they do wonderful work. They kind of feel out, oh, would you want to be adopted by a family that's got two parents? One parent? Would you want a mom? Would you want two dads? And they just kind of feel out what the kid would thrive with. And then I think they also, so they, you know, they might tell you, oh, this kid is looking for a home probably in the country with lots of animals because they don't do well with other children. Mm-hmm. But who knows? I mean, at the end of the day, what I learned is that kid is there just looking to be loved. That's all. Because I was very nervous about meeting our son who had just turned 13. We had been told that he's kind of, you know, he was opinionated. And I was like, what if I walk into this foster home and this 13-year-old just hates me? And it was the opposite of, like, they've been coasting in foster care for 4 years. They just want to land. They want a home. They want somebody that's there to focus on them. And they want it, like, right, this whole traumatic past, you know, they want to put it behind them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, they're lucky and you're lucky, and you know, let gays adopt the kids,
yeah,
that don't have a home.
Yeah. And there's something too, there's something about, I'd heard this years ago, that it's sometimes easier for male couples to adopt because we all have this connection to our bio mother, because most of us attached to our bio mother. And so that's hard to reconcile with, where in our family, our boys were like, oh, we're not trying to be mom. Like we're trying to step in for dad. And their opinion of their father is not high. And so they were looking, I think they were looking for that role model.
I'd also argue that someone who is, you know, LGBTQ plus because of any trauma or because of emotional sensitivities, they are probably even more equipped to help in a situation with a child who has been, shunned or ignored or
othered.
Yeah. So because of that similar, I mean, it's different, but because you're used to that, you have a higher emotional intelligence, you have higher adaptability, you're probably more resourceful because you have to survive.
Yeah, that's, yeah, definitely being an outsider, seeing the world differently is a huge part of that. And then, of course, there's lots of training and reading and whatnot that you do to get your mind into the right place in order to kind of bring them home. But
what to expect when expecting.
Exactly. And then part of it too is just learning to roll with it. And there are little bits of trauma that come back and you just dumbfoundedly bump into them every once in a while. We were having dinner on vacation this summer. Excuse me, breakfast. We were out at a diner, and I don't know why I thought this was funny or something to bring up, but I said, oh, if dad and I get divorced, who are you going to live with? Because Andrew cooks 95% of the time. He's a wonderful cook. And so our youngest is like, yeah, I'd go live with dad. And I was like, yeah, good choice. Like, house might not be that clean, but you're going to be fed well and taken care of. And he's like, he's cuddly and he's sweet and all of that. And I turned to our older son. He's like, oh no, I'm not doing that again. And I realized, oh shoot, I just walked into something bad. And I was like, why? What's going on? He's like, oh, our bio mom and dad used to fight, and then they turned to us and say, when we split up, who are you going to live with? So I had just inadvertently walked into, like, sitting here on a nice, lovely, like, sunny Sunday morning, I thought we were having a fun conversation, and boom, I'd walked right into something. And so that's part of it too, is just, oh, this is a trigger. Okay. I'm going to politely back away. I'm going to show you still that I love you and, you know, I'm a safe adult, but I'm not going to say that again.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you worked for someone else at an architecture company. you had your family, you're in Portland. How do you go from working for someone to I'm going to go on my own.
Yeah.
I'm going to open up my own architecture studio.
The two firms, so I worked for one firm in Eugene and then I worked for another firm in, here in Portland. And I worked at both of them for probably just over 4 years each. And thankfully they were small firms that had five or six people. So pretty quickly, if you knew what you were doing and you had the skills, you would start managing your own projects. So it was a very intimate, close relationship with clients and contractors. So you were already doing all of the elements. So we got in about 4 years into this here in Portland. At that time, I adopted my boys. They moved in June of 2020. So it was the beginning of the pandemic. We were all just figuring out what this new world looked like. And I had always had this dream of, you know, going out and hanging out a shingle on my own. And I think December of 2020, I told my husband, I said, you know what, I'm finally going to do it. I think I have enough contacts. I seem to be generating enough work. And I'm working from home. It's not even like I'm really connecting with my coworkers because we're all at home and I was mostly working on my own projects. And I thought, I'm just going to go try my own thing. And part of that was the two firms that I worked for, the firms were just named after the owners of the firm. And there was something, I think, that was related to my ego of, wow, I'm putting in all this work. And at the end of the day, somebody else's name in a way is on it. Although it's my architectural stamp that goes on the drawings, it's I'm working for somebody else's name and I've never liked that.
And potentially that was a contact that you had or garnered as well, right? Like, or as part of the idea of working for another firm is that there's clients that come to you.
I think when you join a firm, unless you join somehow as a principal or become an owner very quickly, there's work coming to you. There's work being handed down to you. And that's also a good point is too, I like working for my clients, people that come to me through my own social connections or people who have something in common with me. And it's easier to work with those people. And also it's every project has hurdles to climb and you have to be committed to it and you have to be passionate about it. You have to be the cheerleader for it. And it's a heck of a lot easier to do that when you have something in common with that owner and you believe in the project.
So if someone listening is working for someone else and they're like, I want to do that. I want to do what Dan did, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if jump ship is the word, but basically
yeah.
Start their own company. I mean, what would you tell them to think about or how would you tell them to approach that?
For me, I'm a planner, so I don't know if that works for everybody, but I started creating spreadsheet after spreadsheet of, okay, who do I think my clients are? How much work do I need to keep our family afloat? Mm-hmm. So that was my floor number. And I started adding up clients and potential projects. And I thought, okay, that's enough to make the floor work, you know, go for it. And just, you know, really just lay out what you're doing. What do you do every day? What tools, what resources do you need in order to execute your work? And what things can you get by without? And then also, what's your parachute if things don't work out? The reason I had held off for doing this forever is because one, I was learning, you know, who is who in Portland and getting connected because we'd only been here 5 years at the time. But also the stress of, it's not just me living in an apartment. It's me and my husband. And now we've got two kids and I've got to give them a stable life. So it's not like I can live on ramen for a month, you know, there was that pressure of performing. But I would say I have generally found out that things, because of my, I would say almost realistic, maybe almost negative mindset sometimes, that like things have worked out to be so much more positive than they thought they were going to be. And generally, if you think you can do it, you can do it. And the first year has been, there's been a lot of learning, but it has been smoother than I thought it was going to be. Originally, I thought my problem was going to be finding enough work. It's actually been figuring out how to be selective enough to focus on what I really want to focus on and work with who I want to work with and not just accept anybody that walks in the door.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really great sign. Mm-hmm. It also says that you're leaning into who you are and people are picking you for you as
yes.
well.
Mm-hmm.
What makes your company different? So if I'm looking for an architecture firm and I see a bunch of them and then I come across you, mm-hmm. I mean, I know why. And I told the audience earlier, like we've worked with you, you know, you're funny, you're relatable, you're a cool dude. But like if you were selling that or if someone was making a selection,
mm-hmm.
what would be the thing or the things that you would say would make your company stand out?
I would say, thank you. It's always nice to hear nice things about me. And of course, I operate in a little bit of a vacuum, so I never know what sets me apart from the competition. But I like talking. I like picking up the phone and calling permit reviewers or calling a contractor to figure out problems. Like, let's just sit down and be collaborative about this. I of course, need to have the vision of what we're going to complete as an architect, but also I want it to be a collaborative approach. I always bring the contractor early on to figure out how we're going to build something. I want to make sure the client's voice is heard. You know, I certainly have my own aesthetic preferences, but at the end of the day, it's the client's choice. And I want to help them just realize that vision. I think, you know, so working on the house in Nesquin, there was clearly an aesthetic that was well-defined and we needed to make it happen and we had to fit in with the neighborhood. So as Kathy said, they won't tar and feather us and run us out of town if we build some huge gigantic monstrosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then with your house too, it's okay. We've got to have this new kitchen and this new bathroom. How are we going to fit this into this existing crammed envelope? This little box we're working in. How do we make traffic flow? There's only so far we can go. And then, you know, how do you allow a family to live in a modern way, but in this 1904 home? Mm. And then, you know, what's appropriate? That's always a big question. What is appropriate here? What fits into the context? What's appropriate for the client? What's appropriate for the environment here? You know, is it really possible to save this home and remodel it? Or is there something we can do that's a better use of this land and maybe tear it down, move the house, build a new house on the side and subdivide it and put more housing units in or mm-hmm. something? So
I could talk to you for hours, which is not a bad
thing. I know.
But we have a limited amount of time.
We're getting in trouble,
so
aren't we?
We're gonna go to our final questions. I have five questions that I ask everybody. So the first question is, what is a quote or a mantra that you live by?
Can I swear?
Of course you can.
Give a shit. Whatever you're doing, whatever the task is, whether you're filling out a building permit application or designing something or looking into how the sewer flows, get into it and enjoy it. Enjoy the process. Like, learn about it. Ask questions.
You're looking at the sewer, you certainly would give a shit.
You would absolutely. I hadn't thought about that yet. Yeah, that's true. Or you're letting a shit go. But yeah, just like be present in what you're doing.
That's great. And the next one is, what is your favorite childhood memory? Being awarded an Eagle Scout. Is that what that's called or no?
That was not it, but yes, receiving your Eagle Award. Oh my gosh. I think getting up at 5 a.m. and playing with Legos in my room by myself.
Yeah.
Or probably escaping in the library, like just wandering around the library and finding books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. What is a failure or a mistake that you made that actually turned out for the best?
See, I know you ask your guests this, and I've been thinking about it all day, and I'm sure I'll have a really good answer at 2 a.m., and I'll text you about it. But for now, I'm thinking it was when I graduated from undergrad in 2008, architecture firms were laying off everybody, and I just needed a job to pay the rent. And I got a job working folding sweaters. I worked in the back in the stock room at Banana Republic. Worst job ever. I stayed there for 5 years doing something I didn't care about, worked with people. You know, I didn't care about what we were doing. I was just there to get a paycheck, and it was awful. And it's, but actually it's now made me look back on how good my job is. And also it's now this huge example of just be proactive. And if you're miserable, just go do something else. Otherwise you're going to be stuck there forever doing the same thing that you don't want to, folding sweaters and working on Black Friday with a bunch of Karens.
I worked at Abercrombie, but for very, very short, only for like 8-9 months.
See, we all have deep,
and this
dark
was after
secrets.
Law school. I had to move home and study for the bar, and I had to get a mall job. But
We're going to talk about that later.
The mistake is when you let them know you're smart, you end up doing inventory related things, and you're like, "I'm tired. I went to graduate school. Just pay me to be pretty." I mean, I know it sounds horrible.
Wow, Michael.
I've had every job. I've had restaurant jobs. I helped a pregnant lady with her cleaning business. I've done it all.
Okay. Right?
Okay. But it's not about me, and we have limited time.
Okay.
So the next one is, what issue or issues keep you up at night?
We need to get people outside more. We need to give people smaller homes, and we need to figure out how to get people to recreate outside more. Whether it's sitting on, like, the magic of the American front porch needs to be rekindled. It's a social stance of seeing your neighbors, and it's also just getting outside and being comfortable with the world.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, and you would think, okay, well, you're an architect, you're building indoor spaces, but actually you're not. You're building a space that's indoor and outdoor. Or,
and if you build a space that connects to the house, whatever, that connects to the outside, you can get away with a smaller space if it gathers from the outside. And it's, you know, we need, you know, the city of Portland's already doing a good job of pushing the envelope on allowing more housing types, but we need, I mean, we need more tiny homes, and we need more varied housing options that don't just respond to nuclear families with 2.5 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are you reading or watching these days?
I'm watching a lot of true crime documentaries, so I won't go there. The last book I finished that was not related to architecture was a couple weeks ago, and it's called Am I Blue? And it is this collection of short stories about coming out stories, and a friend in high school gave it to me, and it was huge in my own process of coming out to myself and what it meant to be gay. And I hadn't thought about the book for about 20 years. And so I got it off Amazon last month and read it. And then I gave it to my oldest son, and he was like, "Nah, okay." Maybe next year.
And then just finally, give a shout out to someone if you'd like. And also, how can people get a hold of you or reach you?
A shout out, and I have to say that these people are clients, but I have been inspired by them. It's the Yahats Library Commission. They're all volunteers, and there's this tiny, cute little library the size of a house in Yahats, and they are so passionate about what they do, and they're passionate about the library being the living room of the community. It's not about books, but it's about resource and gathering and displaying art, and being kind of this lifeline in so many ways in their community. If you want to get a hold of me, you can just email me. It's dan@bramske, that's B-R-A-M as in Mary, S-K-E.com. Or you can always check out my work at bramske.com, and I've got a contact form there. And if anyone's listening, I want to say, if you have questions, if you even think you need an architect, or you just want to talk about a project you're considering, call me or email me. And I always love those conversations. I just got a Facebook message on my way here from somebody who's like, "Well, we're thinking about maybe designing our retirement home, but you met with another architect and didn't the conversation went flat. So I'm going to meet with them and just kind of figure out where they're at.
Flat, Dan.
Thank you. I am not. Yes. How would you describe me?
Full? No.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Shoot. It's time for a diet.
I am very happy to call you friend and our family architect. Yes. I don't know if that's a thing, but it's a thing, I guess.
Okay.
And thank you for doing good community work and for taking another stereotypical professional trade, mm-hmm, like architecture, and leaning into who you are and making it your own. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me. And now I know where to continue to focus. And sometimes I get so used to working on what's in front of me, and then you hear somebody talk about what you actually do, and I'm like, oh, that's right, I do that.